Kyla Farrell Smith is an artist and activist from the Klamath Tribe in Southern Oregon. We recently spoke about the proposed pipeline between Malin and Coos Bay, Oregon. The pipeline would run through 485 waterways and her tribe's ancestral sacred lands.
Waklisi, Gausasis Kaila, Nua Uksik Ini'i, Nua Modakni'i. I just said in Klamath, hey, how's it going? My name's Kaila, and I'm from the Klamath and Modoc Nations.
I always call myself an I-5 baby. I was like born in Ashland, grew up in Eugene, ended up going to the city for school. So I moved to Portland when I was 18, lived in the city for 18 years. I've traveled a lot, went to art school, did my undergrad and graduate degrees in Portland. I work for Signal Fire, which is an artist residency that engages artists, activists, and creative agitators with public lands. So we go out backpacking, camping, canoeing. So the first trip that I was a co-guide with was down through my ancestral homelands. And so we went to the lava beds, we went to the lakes, we went through Chiloquin. That was really inspiring to me. And I kept going back and kept going back down there, traveling multiple times for different reasons. And I was just so happy in being in my ancestral homelands, being in Southern Oregon. I loved it. I love it there.
Our people are from within the nation state, Southern Oregon and Northern California. Mm-hmm. Our ancestral homelands are we're lake people in like the high desert.
The Klamath and Modoc tribes are at the headwaters of many rivers and many waterways in the area. Mm-hmm. And so we have always been related to the downriver tribes, which are in Northern California. So there's downriver is Hoopa, Yurok, Wiat, and Kuruk, and many other. There's many others. I'm not recalling all of them right now. So all of these tribes, we're dependent on clean water, fresh water. So this really is about, you know, water is life. Mm-hmm. It's our first food. Mm-hmm. Most of Southern Oregon is ranchers. Mm-hmm. And we've been fighting water wars down there for a long time. Mm-hmm. The ranchers want water for their farms and for cows. And the tribe, Klamath tribes, we want water, we need water for healthy lakes so that we can bring our fish back. This is our food sustenance. And the main thing we're wanting to bring back now is our chawam, which is a Klamath word for sucker fish. Mm-hmm. And the impacts of the agricultural and ranching communities on the lakes has been disastrous. Mm. We've been able to bring back and preserve some of our freshwater healthy ecosystems. So in our lakes, this is our life. This is everything we harvest from the lakes. Mm. So our tule, cattail is what we weave all our baskets with. Mm. Wokus is our food sustenance. So wokus is a lily pad, and inside the pod is the seeds, and we process that, and that is an ancient food source for us, as well as fish. The chawam, we can't even harvest the chawam because there's so few left. Down in Southern Oregon, we have these incredible petroglyphs, and they are large, huge, abstract petroglyphs that it is thought, or it's been speculated by these archaeologists, that they were made over generations, and that people would come and gather, because we were definitely hunters and gatherers in that area. I went out with archaeologists to the Paisley Caves, which isn't in the pipeline route, but it's very close. And we have artifacts, we have evidence of human existence from 14,500 years before present on a calendar year. And that's just what's been dated.
Documented. Yeah.
We have ancient archaeological sites all through Southern Oregon. So that's something that I would like to work on, is getting, proving, and bringing that ancient art and culture to the forefront of this fight. That's not a part of the dialogue right now, but I really want that to become a part of this conversation as we move forward. My father's name is Al Smith, which I know doesn't sound like a Klamath name, but the history of colonization is that they imposed the names and language upon the indigenous people. So Al Smith, my dad, was born in 1919 in Modoc Point, Oregon. His mother and grandparents spoke Klamath. He harvested wokus on the lakes with his grandma, who went to pick berries in wintertime. They lived indigenous lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And at this time, when he was about 6 or 7 years old in the 1920s, he was stolen by nuns or by the government. I'm not sure exactly who showed up, but he says they came with buses. Mm-hmm. And they bused him, they took the kids away, mm-hmm. and they were put into boarding schools. Mm-hmm. And he went from Catholic boarding schools, Indian boarding schools, all across the state of Oregon. He was taken to Carson City, Nevada, and ended up at Chamawa, which is still a boarding school, Indian boarding school, a different type now, nowadays. Mm. So my dad's life, his story, it goes on. He went to World War II, came home. He lived through all of the assimilation policies mm. that the government imposed on Native tribes, mm-hmm. specifically in Oregon. Mm. He ended up in Portland, and he was an alcoholic until he was 36 years old. Mm-hmm. When he sobered up, he was down in L.A. then at that point. He got into AA, and mm-hmm. that was a huge point for him. But mm-hmm. he always shared with about his life that he didn't have his cultural practices. He didn't have the cultural language. He didn't speak Klamath. He didn't have the ceremonies, mm-hmm. the spiritual connections. Mm-hmm. That happened, the assimilation, to some degree, worked. Mm. But it wasn't until he was later in his life, I think he was in his 50s, and he ended up doing lots of work helping Native people in recovery. So he spent his life working as an alcohol and drug counselor for a lot of people, but definitely specifically for Native people.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, he worked nationally, locally, at the state level, nationally, traveling to reservations, traveling to tribal communities, and building a different format of the AA structure, because for him, the Christian, going to God and the Christian aspect of it didn't work. And it doesn't work for a lot of Native people. Mm-hmm. And so what he worked to do was bring indigenous ceremonies into this recovery program.
Wow.
Sweat Lodge ceremony, Sundance ceremony, and eventually the Native American church, peyote ceremony. Al Smith has a very famous court case called Al Smith versus Oregon, mm-hmm. and it's one of the biggest freedom of religion cases in the history of the United States. It went to the Supreme Court. Mm. This was in the 80s when I was a little kid. There's two books written about my dad's case. Basically, what happened, though, is that the Supreme Court denied Al Smith, a Klamath tribal member, denied him the freedom of religion to go to Native American church. And they described this as like gutting, you know, our constitutional rights. They cited that case in the Hobby Lobby decision to give rights to a corporation so that they could deny women health care. That's the state of the United States of where we're at. But I have to follow up and say that what happened with Al's case is that they ended up proposing the restoration. It's a restoration of Native American Religious Freedom Act. And so it ended up, Bill Clinton did sign this into law just for Native American religion, and all Native people are now able to legally go to Native American church and participate in the peyote ceremony. So it was a really incredible outcome that came out of Al's case. Indigenous connection to land and place and holding our ceremonies, this is going to be really important in the fight that we're going forward with. Mm-hmm. Al never was able to come home. He never, the trauma from the colonization was too much for him to be able to come home to his mom's land, his grandma's land. Mm-hmm. I remember being younger and going down there with him. He could barely get out of the car because it was too much for him. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the story of a lot of that generation, mm-hmm. and younger than him, mm-hmm. you know, because my father was a lot older. He lived a long life and did a lot of amazing things. So it's been 4 years now since my father passed away, and we brought him home, put his ashes, you know, in with his people, with his sisters and mom and grandma. Me and my partner, Kale Christie, and my family, we sold our small little property that we had got in Portland. Mm-hmm. And because the tribe's fully terminated, we don't have a land base. So we did purchase some property, and I've now moved down to Modoc Point, where my dad's from, in Chiloquin. So there's multiple different reasons, but definitely this pipeline fight. A cousin, Natalie M. Ball, is also a Modoc and Klamath artist. She was a visiting artist and was so generous and took us up to a sacred place called Singing Rock. And, you know, it was empowering for me to see Natalie. She moved home about probably 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, and she's now raising her family there, her kids. Harvesting food, you know, living living in our homelands. That was really inspiring to me. And I kept going back and kept going back down there, traveling multiple times for different reasons. And I was just so happy in being in my ancestral homelands, being in Southern Oregon. I loved it. I love it there. It's been profound. There aren't words in the English language to express how powerful the land is, how powerful the ancestors are, because they're there and we feel them. We know they're there. In these times, I feel I speak of it as like the veil is very thin, you know, where the ones that have passed over, and whether that be children in Yemen, in Syria, whether that be ancestors that died from the genocide that happened on this land. Mm-hmm. They're all there. We all remember, they remember, they're here. Anyway, so I feel that in going home, it's like I feel that even more than I ever did locked in like the concrete jungle of a city. Mm-hmm. I felt it when I leave the city and go out on backpacking trips or camping or hiking. You know, then you start to remember, you feel cold water. You know, when you jump in a river, you feel the cold water wakes you up, you know, mm-hmm. you remember, mm-hmm. oh, I'm a human being. Mm-hmm. Like, we've done this before. We hunt our food, we harvest our food, we have these reciprocal relationships with land and place and with one another. Mm-hmm. And that's what being human is. Mm-hmm. And so kind of there's this core of, like, being a human being, mm-hmm. and having a natural spiritual connection with a place, mm-hmm. but really, you know, coming back to ancestral homelands where my people are from, that is, it's beautiful. I love going to the water. I love being near our sacred water. And so visiting the rivers, going up to Crater Lake, Giwas, these are special places. Mm-hmm. And across the mountains too, going east over to Summer Lake, I've been spending a lot of time over there and learning. There's all our petroglyphs are all over the rock walls, soaking in our hot springs. I don't know. It's like I can transport myself back to, I don't know, if that's ancestral memory, it's like you feel it. Mm-hmm. It's really deep level. So mm-hmm. it's everything. I think a lot of people in my generation, tribal members, are feeling very protective of wanting to protect our clean water, wanting to protect our ancestral homelands. We want to be able to harvest wokas, harvest tule. We want to learn how to weave baskets and carve canoe, you know, our canoe paddles and go back. Yeah. Go back, but also go forward. Mm. There's language speakers. I went to my very first language class at Natalie's house with another Klamath tribal member, Joe Dupree, who's studying to teach Klamath and indigenous languages through a really beautiful format of sign language, no translation, and learning by watching other people through this process.
The way kids learn.
Yes. So these are all things we have. We have bits, we have strands, we have stories and memories, and I think together, collectively, we all want to walk with intention, with sustainability, with ecological justice, with love for one another, for these relationships, both with humans, non-humans, with mm-hmm. animals, with the plant life, mm-hmm. and protect what we have left. Mm-hmm. The difficulties are convincing tribal councils to hear the opposition to this project. At this point, I think they're only hearing the pro side of this project. So these Pembina and Jordan Cove have been influencing and sending in representatives, native people, to meet with the tribal councils and to meet with the tribal chairman. I've heard this directly from the mouth of our tribal chairman, Don Gentry of the Klamath tribes. Mm-hmm. And he said they sent in a native person, probably First Nations from Canada, who came and wanted to meet with him and brought him tobacco, which is an offering in our culture, mm-hmm. to get him to flip and switch and be pro Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector Pipeline. Wow. So that's the level of their infiltration. Job creation is the big myth.
Yeah.
And they're trying to sell this as a clean energy source.
Right.
So it's it's all lies and smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. In reality, I mean, this is at the point where we're facing the drastic impacts of climate change, mm-hmm. that we need to all work together across communities, across differences, and stop this insanity. It's something a academic, Michael Yellowbird, he's Lakota, and you can look this up. It's on YouTube. It's called Decolonizing the Mind. And he studies neuroscience, and he gives these, it's an incredible lecture he gives, but he calls the settler colonial mentality, he calls it colonizer's brain disorder. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're up against. Mm-hmm. It's a brain disorder, mm-hmm. that if you have that, if you have no empathy for other human beings, like there's something not connecting in the brain.
Yes.
And we all need to work on that. For our, you know, within our own communities and relationships, mm-hmm. but as a larger society, like we need to talk about it in those terms. Mm. It's sort of like you have to think of the settler colonial framework on indigenous land, mm-hmm. is just conflicting in general. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's like two different worldviews on how we look at place, resources, materials, and if you look at it from an indigenous epistemology, it's about this interconnected nature of everything and everyone, and reciprocity. You take what you need, but you give back, and you give that thanks, or you give that prayer. So when I go to harvest water or harvest food, you know, you leave tobacco, you say, you leave prayers, and we have songs for that and language for that. And I'm just at the beginning of starting to learn this, even mm-hmm. though I was raised in ceremonies and around these cultural practices, but a lot of them were from other tribes. Mm. And that's another part of Oregon history, is that there was so much lost in through these assimilation policies in Oregon. Yes. So there was so many different policies meant to disconnect indigenous people from land, place, family, culture, mm-hmm. and art practices. Mm-hmm. This is colonization 101. And we're seeing it right now repeat itself. Ripping children from their families and putting them in concentration camps.
Yes.
It is the exact same thing that they did to Native children. They've done it all around the globe. I've been to conferences, Indigenous Peoples conferences in Hawaii, and heard from Maori people, Aboriginal people, First Nations people in Canada, Philippines. This is colonization 101. They rip you from your culture and your land. Mm-hmm. So the relocation programs remove Natives to cities. So there's lots of Native people that were brought into these cities and dropped off, and we're supposed to be put into jobs programs. And of course, they put this all under the guise of, you're now going to be a part of, you know, American modern civilization. Didn't really work. I mean, to some degree, it did work. And I mean, it's all of this stuff is really intense, and there's so many layers.
Very complicated.
Very complicated. But my point is that there was people from the Lakota culture and community that ended up in Oregon through these relocation programs. So I grew up in what I would consider an urban, intertribal community. And part of that community was we participated in the Sundance ceremony, and that was brought to us and shared with us from Lakota medicine men who went back to their medicine people and asked them if they could bring this ceremony out and share it with these indigenous communities, because we were so devastated, mm-hmm. and we were lacking so much of our culture and language. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in that community, mm-hmm. and I've been able to have a connection, mm-hmm. to prayer and to ceremony and to community. Mm-hmm. So I'm so thankful that those men and women did that. The women that cook in that kitchen, mm-hmm. and really the matriarchs that hold that spirit of that, of our communities alive, mm-hmm. and the men that dance and sing on the drum. And so in some way, we were able to hold on to parts of our culture and community. Mm-hmm. And you know what that original prayer was, or at least the way it's been told to me, is that it was going to hold place long enough until we were ready to go back and start learning our own language and culture and songs and ceremonies. So in my lifetime, this has happened. From having a shared, you know, ceremony into where now my generation is moving back to the homelands, mm-hmm. going back to cultural practices and sisterhood. I think that's really huge, mm-hmm. that we don't want to have toxic, competitive relationships with one another, mm-hmm. that we want to support one another, mm-hmm. in whatever we want to do, in endeavors that we want to pursue. You know, I talk about decolonization in a class I teach, and those stages of decolonization from this Hawaiian academic Poka Lau Nui. He talks about the stages of colonization, the last one being exploitation and tokenism. But then he goes on to describe these processes of decolonization, the first one being remembering and reclaiming, and then mourning, and then dreaming, commitment, and action. And the thing is to remember that this isn't linear. These things can be happening at all different times, and we can be in different stages of them all the time. But just to remember that we're all feeling this, and we just got to be there for one another. The Klamath tribes were one of the most self-sufficient tribes in the country because of timber sales of timber. We have ponderosa pine, lodgepole pine. We have a lot of beautiful trees. So the Menominee and the Klamath tribes were the first tribes to be fully terminated because of they wanted to control the timber. Mm-hmm. It's all about natural resources. Mm-hmm. This is how settler colonialism works. It's how the United States of America works. Mm-hmm. They're bullies. And they want it, they think they can go anywhere and take whatever they want. Mm-hmm. So that's how the Termination Act started. So this was in 1954, we were fully terminated. Every Klamath tribal member, if they cashed the check, I think it was around $40,000. It was a forced assimilation. It was a forced land theft. A lot of the tribal members, this is a shame. My father was very ashamed that he took the money. There was, and he talks about that, but that, I think that was why he wanted to take on the fight, the freedom of religion fight, because yes. He felt like he, and so that was a thing, you know, like a lot of people felt like they sold out because they took the money. He now realizes that it was a forced assimilation, or he, when he was speaking, talks about it in different terms. There was one man that never cashed the check, and his name is Edison Chiliquin. And I think it took years, maybe 20 years, his fight, he finally got his land, his little plot of land. They finally gave him his land back. And my dad was there with Edison Chiliquin. They held sacred fire during, you know, they had encampments down there. So the spirituality part is really important, that survivance, you know, living in survivance, resiliency is really important, and keeping that prayer, keeping that spirit has been really important for all of these indigenous fights. You know, these fights are going on around the world. But coming back to the Klamath tribes, you know, we were terminated in 1954, so that was the land was taken. So we don't have a land base anymore. We don't have a reservation. But we were federally recognized, I believe it was in 1987. So we have federal recognition, and it took a lot to fight for getting restored as a tribe. And so, like, we have our restoration powwow every summer and celebrate the fact that we are restored and we are a tribe, and we're very proud of who we are, where we come from, and our connections to this sacred place, this ancient place, and this place of water and volcanoes and our first foods. And we're there to protect that now. Economic impacts were devastating, which was the point. They didn't want us to have control over our own lifestyles and economic stability. So the impacts of termination were devastating to the tribe and tribal members. And I go back to that, the people felt like they sold out, or other tribes were like, oh, you Klamath sold out. That was a narrative that spun through with other Oregon tribal members.
How painful.
And it's very painful. And so that healing that has had to happen has been generations.
Yeah.
Generations of healing. And but the impacts, there's extreme poverty in our communities with our people. People don't have the empowerment or the voice to know how powerful they are. And I think we have some really unique opportunities to bring life back to this place and to these communities and to the Klamath and Modoc and Yahooskin people specifically. And I don't know if it would be going back to timber sales or, you know, but I think we need to restore these lakes. And that's what we're working on. That's the number one priority for the Klamath tribes. Talking about economics right now, the U.S. government basically owes the Klamath tribe $500,000 for restoration of our lakes. to specifically bring back the chuam, the suckerfish. They're holding out. They're not giving us the money. So that's something that's happening right now. So it's not only what happened with termination, severing our economic autonomy, but then withholding funds that we need to restore our lake and waters.
When were those funds promised?
Like last year. It's for this year. This is right now happening. I don't want history to repeat itself. I want us to be smart enough to remember, learn from the mistakes, and like start walking on a new path, a green future. Mm-hmm. And I've heard prophecies about this before, mm-hmm. and I don't even remember where. Probably out at Standing Rock, they talk about the black snake. You know, these things have been prophesized, mm-hmm. been talked about from indigenous communities and people. Mm-hmm. Winona LaDuke, I've heard she speaks about this, that we have, there's the scorched earth policy, and it's like, we've done that. Let's stop. Scorched earth policy doesn't, you know, I don't know what the end game is here with that mentality. I think it's really scary, but we have to have this like green path, mm-hmm. a green path forward, and we all need to choose to join that path together. We in Oregon are fighting a pipeline proposal. It's actually two projects. Pembina is a Canadian company that owns Jordan Cove. And so we're fighting the Jordan Cove export terminal, which would be in Coos Bay, Oregon, which is on the coast. And the pipeline is called the Pacific Connector Pipeline. And that pipeline would be 235 miles long, running from Lynn, Oregon, through my ancestral homelands, which goes right through the Klamath lands and Modoc ancestral territories. Mm-hmm. All the way to the coast to Coos Bay. Mm. And in Malin, Oregon, is where they would build this gigantic compressor station. So the Pacific Connector pipeline would be linking up to the Ruby pipeline. And I think this is how they're doing, is they're piecing together these small pipeline projects to try to pass this legislation through. Mm-hmm. And Pembina is right now filtering in so much money into our communities. They're spending $10 million a month. They want to take the frack gas, so that it's methane, mm-hmm. Which is even worse than coal. Mm. It's a disastrous, you know, the fracking industry is, I mean, this is happening all across the world, yes. and all across our country, all across this country, as you well know. Mm-hmm. We're fighting pipelines everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so actually at this point, I want to say that we as a state and as a community have stopped this project twice already. So this has been going on for like the last 12 years. We've been fighting LNG projects for a long time. Oregonians do not want this, regardless of what Jordan Cove sends out in their mailers or what they're saying on their TV ads. This is not in the benefit of Oregonians. And that's clear because we've stopped this project twice already. It's the only pipeline project that's been denied by FERC. FERC is Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they denied it twice because it's such a devastating project to tribes, water, land, and property owners who are being threatened with eminent domain. We call it a zombie pipeline project because this is now the third time, but of course, under the Trump administration, it's like a totally new game, right? They want to shove this through. You know, this is a huge priority to lay in this infrastructure for liquefied natural gas pipelines, mm-hmm. to transport this to Asian markets. But we are organized. Uh-huh. We have very well-organized volunteers and nonprofits. And I was just out there visiting the compressor station that's there now with some other activists from both Oregon, from the Klamath tribes, mm-hmm. landowners, mm-hmm. and from folks from Colorado. Mm-hmm. So what we're working to do is bridge the communities from Colorado to southern Oregon. Mm-hmm. So that Colorado is where they're being fracked, and how that is damaging their communities. So we really want to build coalitions between these communities that are being fracked within Colorado, Wyoming, Canada, and then they would be shipping that gas through and building this pipeline through our homelands, both ancestral tribal homelands, but it would also impact landowners because they are threatening to take their land through eminent domain. The tribes that are being affected and impacted by these pipeline and export terminal projects are the Klamath, Modoc, Yahooskin, Coos, Coquille, Hanas, Cow Creek. There's a lot mm-hmm. of indigenous nations. Some are federally recognized, some are not. The Klamath tribe is the only tribe in Oregon that's opposed this project, and we have 9 federally recognized tribes.
Wow.
So we're working on building coalitions with other tribal nations in Oregon to come out in opposition to this project. Mm-hmm. But as of right now, it's still only the Klamath tribes who is opposed the mm-hmm. Jordan Cove and mm-hmm. Pacific Connector Pipeline project. Downriver, though, at least two of the tribes, I think it's Yurok and Karuk, have come out in opposition mm-hmm. of this project. The other huge impact is the Jordan Cove terminal would be the largest greenhouse gas emitter in the state of Oregon. To build this, they would have to dredge Coos Bay to bring in these LNG tankers. They're the largest vessels in the ocean. They're the size of like 3 football fields. Mm. And to do that, it would destroy not only the tourism, but the oysters, the fishing communities, and this is all communities, mm-hmm. and as well as being the first foods and ancestral food source for the Coos, Coquille, Haunas tribes mm-hmm. that are right there where they want to build the Jordan Cove export terminal. I don't know how many permanent jobs there would be at the Jordan Cove terminal. I think it's around like 150, 200 max. It's just not worth it.
No.
At all for the impact on our communities, the fire threat, the pollution of our clean water. It's a tsunami zone. So putting an LNG plant that would be shipping this gas, if a tsunami happened or an earthquake, this thing is a firebomb.
Yeah.
It would blow up and it would destroy communities mm-hmm. around Coos Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're predicting a major earthquake along the West Coast at any time.
Yes.
So this is again why I personally feel that this is a really insane project. It's different than what was happening at Standing Rock mm-hmm. in North Dakota. In Oregon, this pipeline is going through all white communities mm-hmm. or mixed ethnic communities. Mm-hmm. Malin, Oregon, I believe, is majority or over 50% Latinx communities, mm-hmm. which is another part of this that isn't being talked about because mm-hmm. where that compressor station is, like I mentioned, that gas that leaks makes you sick.
Yes.
Gives you a headache. It's really bad for you. I don't know all the implications. My brain felt really fuzzy. It felt like there was definitely, I was smelling gas. And it gave me a headache. And I ended up getting a nosebleed after I left. I was there with Taylor Tupper, a Klamath tribal member. She works for the tribe. And she's running for office, mm-hmm. state representative. Mm-hmm. We were there together. And we both were expressing on film our physical symptoms that we were having while we were at the compressor station. I had physical symptoms from being there for 5 minutes. And that's with the size of the compressor station there now, it's very small.
Okay.
I believe it's going to be like 10 times larger. Like, we looked at the land and saw the plot of how large this thing would be. I would say the one that is there now would be roughly the size of a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're proposing would be 10 football fields. And right now, I think it's an alfalfa farm. That's what the land's being used for. And this is all ranching land. Mm-hmm. So I want that to be very clear. So most of Southern Oregon is ranchers. Mm-hmm. We are doing a lot of work, grassroots organizing in Southern Oregon. And it's a network of nonprofits, volunteers like myself, just concerned citizens. And together we signed on to oppose this on the FERC website, like during their processes. Basically, right now in Oregon, we're doing good. Pipes are not in the ground. So that means we're winning.
Yes.
That means we're winning.
Yes.
But they keep reapplying, changing little things within their proposals. Mm-hmm. It's all like lost in this bureaucracy mm-hmm. and language. Mm-hmm. But luckily, with this incredible network mm-hmm. of brilliant people and concerned citizens and organizations, we are combing through all of that, all the legal and bureaucratic paperwork, mm-hmm. and we're figuring out how to fight them that way. And so that's how we've been doing this for so long. So the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, mm-hmm. and the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, can stop this project right now in its tracks. You can call Kate Brown and ask her to oppose the Jordan Cove export terminal and the Pacific Connector pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely one thing everybody can do.
Great.
We had over 42,000 public comments that went to the DEQ opposing this project, and the DEQ denied the Jordan Cove application they had. So people can engage that way. We had people from out of state that were engaging in that process.
Mm-hmm.
And we will link up with Rogue Climate and No LNG Exports as the other nonprofit that's working diligently on stopping these projects. Join us in the streets and at actions, whether it's in Salem, Oregon, to tell Kate Brown how we feel about this project
mm-hmm.
and express those concerns that way.
Mm-hmm.
Getting engaged, calling the elected officials who have a say-so in this. And so, you know, right now that's local politicians at the county and state, you know, county levels. Jordan Cove is paying a lot of these politicians to be in support of this. They need to hear from their constituents. That's the way this works. People need to engage in democracy while we still have it.
Do you have any parting words for us?
Stay vigilant. Stay strong. Talk to one another face to face to remember that we're not alone in this fight. Get out, don't stop watching TV. It's really not going to help. And get out. Call your elected officials. Go organize. It's grassroots organizing. I've been a grassroots organizer for a long time, and it works. We just need people to not be afraid. Like what they were saying at Standing Rock, like find your warrior spirit or face your warrior spirit, because this is it. This is our fight as human beings if we want to live on this earth in a sustainable way.
This is Molly Stinchfield for FAEX Radio. This episode was recorded and produced by Molly Stinchfield and edited by Melissa Weaver. FAEX is an artist residency program in the Catskills for social justice and environmental sustainability artists. For more information, go to freeholdartexchange.org.